Today is Wednesday, October 4th, 2023. This is part 9 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Peter Huntoon. Peter spells his last name H-U-N-T-O-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Very good.
Super. Peter, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Last time in part 8, you talked about you'd gotten a job at the University of Wyoming, and this mapping project came up in Canyonlands, and you and George Billingsley, working with Park Superintendent Peter Perry, worked on this map. And you also mentioned a couple times the Department of Energy. Can you tie the energy into the mapping and how that all worked out?
Well, one of the threats that Perry faced right after he got the job of being the head of Canyonlands was that the Department of Energy was looking for a high-level nuclear waste repository for the waste that was coming out of the reactors in the United States.
Okay.
And what they had done was they had chosen a couple of sites near Canyonlands on the east side of Canyonlands National Park that looked very attractive to them.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, Perry was faced with this threat that, gee, the Department of Energy might be trying to site a nuclear waste repository within a couple of miles of the east side of Canyonlands National Park.
Peter, can you back up a minute and just tell us lay people what kind of site the Department of Energy would be looking for, because nuclear waste seems like it lasts an awful long time.
What are they
looking for?
Well, what they wanted to find was a final geologic repository where they could leave the waste and it wouldn't threaten the environment or any people. Now, this is a very large charge, and let's just back up for a second and talk about this.
Please.
In terms of what the nuclear waste is.
Okay.
If we take a typical fuel rod out of a nuclear reactor,
okay,
after it no longer can produce enough fission to create heat to run the plant,
okay,
then they take this waste and they want to isolate it. And what they have in mind is an isolation system that's got multiple layers. And if you think about it from the inside out, the fuel rod itself holds the waste. So that's the first barrier.
Okay.
Then they put in a canister, a highly engineered metal canister, and that's the second barrier.
Okay.
And then the idea is you take that and you put it in some geologic repository, a rock, which wouldn't allow the material to dissipate if the canister decays. And what you're looking for is something with virtually no permeability. So that's the third layer around this thing, the third barrier. And then the overlying stratigraphy above that rock horizon forms your final barrier. So what we're looking at is a four-part system that keeps this stuff from coming out into the environment,
okay,
and causing a threat.
So now, I'm going to jump in here because you've already mentioned that the Colorado Plateau, especially in the southwest region, in the Grand Canyon area, you have these faults that take the water, but you have no running rivers on the surface.
Right.
Except maybe in the spring, some sort of a melt event. But even then, it might be like a week or so, and then it's gone. So I would assume at first blush, rocking back on my heels here in my ignorance, that the Colorado Plateau might be a good idea for something like this.
Well, that's what everybody was thinking.
Okay.
And we'll get to that. And
okay.
We'll get to that pretty quick.
Okay.
Now, let me tell you what the problem is for the DOE in looking for a site like this.
Okay.
We'll just talk about general things. Mm. If we take the typical fuel rod,
yep,
what it has in it is the uranium-238 that hasn't fissioned.
Okay.
It has uranium-235, which did fission, but not all of it.
Okay.
And it has all the waste products that were created when the U-235 fissioned.
Okay.
When the U-235 fissions, some of the neutrons that come out of it plow into the U-238, and they get absorbed by the U-238 and turn it into plutonium.
Okay.
Now, plutonium is the thing that we made one of the atomic bombs out of.
Okay.
Anyway, the idea is that now we got this plutonium that's sitting in the fuel rod along with the other stuff, and what they're going to do is throw that away. The problem is the plutonium has a long half-life. It has a half-life of 24,400 years. So it's going to take a long time for the plutonium to decay down to a safe level, and the DOE is going to try to find a repository that'll hold it long enough for it to decay down to where it's safe, where you can.
So let me think about this for a minute. If a half-life is 24,400 years, does that mean that in 48,800 years it's safe?
Or no.
No. All right, help me out.
No.
What kind of time are we looking at here?
Okay, all the half-life says is the half-life is when half of the plutonium will have decayed to something safer.
Oh, so the other half is still there waiting.
Yeah, the other half is waiting.
Okay.
So what we have to do is look at a number of half-lives until we get this plutonium down to a safe level.
Okay.
That's approved by, say, the Environmental Protection Agency.
Okay.
That you can handle it.
Okay.
And it turns out that that magic number is 405,000 years.
Holy cow.
Wait.
Let me think about this. 405,000 years, that's roughly 500,000 years.
Yep.
So that's like all of the Quaternary. I'm just trying to put this in geologic perspective. I mean, it's not like, you know, till the Mississippian, 300 million years ago. No, it's not that. So it's fairly young, but still 500,000 years to be left alone.
Yeah, there's two problems. One is civilization as we understand it, and the oldest structures we have from civilizations, you know, are things like about 4,000 years ago, right?
Okay. Yeah, the Hittites and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And what we're asking is you make me a little container that holds this stuff for 100 times that.
Ooh.
Length of time. And then, on top of that, you create a marker that tells people that there's something dangerous here and they shouldn't dig. And you want that marker to last for 405,000 years.
Ooh.
It's a pretty demanding request.
Rather.
Yeah, this is the essence of the problem that the people that handle nuclear waste have to face.
Okay.
And it's a very large charge. And of course it gets people stirred up.
Yeah, and nuclear waste keeps being generated by the nuclear power plants all around the planet, and they, you know, every year that stockpiles of plutonium in these rods just goes up and up.
Yeah, they're just putting them on temporary storage, waiting for a facility to be built. And they were feeling the pressure under this. And so what happened was Congress designated the Department of Energy as the owner of this waste, and they charged them to find a repository to get rid of it.
Okay.
And so what they did, let's just talk about a little of the hierarchy. What the DOE did was they hired a contractor to oversee this program, and that contractor was charged with trying to find a suitable site.
Okay.
The name of the contractor was the Battelle Memorial Institute.
Okay.
And the Battelle Memorial Institute hired and set up an office within itself called the Office of Nuclear Waste Isolation.
Okay.
And the Office of Nuclear Waste Isolation hired a consulting firm to do the initial screening for them, and this was an outfit called Woodward Clyde Associates. Okay, so these are the big players, and what they did before this thing landed on Perry's lap was they'd already done a preliminary site screening, looking at the geology of the entire United States to try to find a suitable site.
Right.
And the other thing they did is that they developed guidance documents on just what the characteristics of the repository should have.
Okay.
For example, the guidance documents had a lot of geologic guidance in it. One thing they didn't want was active faults. They didn't want breccia pipes. They didn't want any dissolution features, collapse features from caves or anything like that.
Makes sense.
Things like that.
Yep,
the
makes
idea
sense.
Is, yeah, the idea is they simply didn't want anything that was geologic that could leak from a repository.
Okay.
Okay, so that's what they did. And they had already, the DOE had already done this for the country, and they had come up with a list of five sites. And what they wanted Woodward Clyde to do was to look at the Canyonlands site and help them prioritize these five sites.
Okay.
Now let's talk about the five sites, because that's where it gets real interesting. The DOE had made a list, and this list was almost prioritized in what they wanted. And the first thing on the list was a place called Davis Canyon, which happened to be a canyon just east of Canyonlands National Park. The number two site was Lavender Canyon, which was a canyon about a mile and a half away from Davis Canyon. The third site was a thing called Deaf Smith Canyon, which was in western Texas. And then the fourth site was the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington, where they were already handling a lot of nuclear waste. And the fifth site was Yucca Mountain in Utah on the Nevada test site, and that was another federal facility where they used to test atomic bombs.
Okay.
Now, the thing about Davis Canyon, Lander Canyon, and Deaf Smith Canyon was the horizon they were looking at was a salt body.
And in particular, we've
already been talking about salt. Right?
You mean that Lander and Davis and Deaf Smith are on top of this same salt basin deposit that with the potash and the 100-foot thick salt beds?
Yeah, and it was way down there.
Okay.
Yeah, they loved it. Now let's just talk about.
Wait a minute. What do you mean they loved it? The whole thing is like moving. The whole thing is moving. It's a slippery bunch of grease.
Yeah, but they like that, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Okay. This is where it gets to be interesting. Okay, we've got Davis Canyon, we got Lavender Canyon next to Canyonlands, and we got Deaf Smith Canyon in Texas.
Okay.
They have buried salt deposits.
Uh-huh.
Okay, underneath Davis and Lavender Canyon, it's about 2,000 or so feet down to the salt layer, about a half a mile.
All right.
So the idea is you make a shaft a half a mile deep, get to the salt layer, then you mine tunnels in the salt layer horizontally, and you put the canisters of waste in those tunnels. Now, you've already talked about this slippery aspect of salt. There are two really important attractive features. One is the salt itself is 320 million years old or something like that. It's Pennsylvanian in age.
Okay.
And it's still there, right?
Oh, so it's pretty stable.
Yeah, it looks stable and it hasn't dissolved. At least they don't think it's dissolved.
Okay.
So that means that, hey, look, we're talking about 320 million years. This stuff is 320 million years old. It's going to last a half a million years. No problem.
Think, yeah, okay.
The other thing they like about it is that it does flow. So once they leave the mine and they seal the mine that they put this stuff in, then the wolves will slowly creep around the canisters and seal them up. And this idea had been kicking around since the 50s. And, this was a very attractive thing about salt. Now, the other thing was, we're looking at Hanford and Yucca Mountain. These were largely bedded volcanic rocks, and they had low permeability. They didn't flow or anything like that, but they wanted to just build mines into those, drill holes in the floor, and drop the canisters down these holes and walk away from it. And what all of these sites are in the West, and they're in arid regions, so they don't have to deal with a lot of water, okay. They hope.
Right.
And that's why we got this. Another attractive thing about these sites, particularly the ones in Utah and Washington, is they were in states with small congressional delegations.
Okay.
But anyway, the whole idea, and Nevada particularly, when we look at this. So what we have is this very interesting-looking geologic site, and it's sitting 2 or 3 miles from the eastern park boundary at Canyonlands National Park. And they're asking now Woodward Clyde to evaluate Davis and Lavender Canyons and see if they really are as suitable as the big picture looks like.
Okay.
So what we're into is the first stage of site screening. And what the charge of the consultants are that are looking at these various sites is to provide the DOE with enough information that DOE can take that information and make a real priority list out of it.
Okay.
And what the DOE is after is 2 sites out of these 5 that look suitable. And so everybody's looking at this list wondering how it's going to come out. And if the repository, the proposed repository, falls below number 2, it's out of consideration.
Okay.
So this is very, very, you know, electric, right? And now let me tell you what's going to happen. After Woodward Clyde gets the contract for looking at Lavender Canyon and Davis Canyon, they're going to spend a couple of years looking at this thing, and here's going to be the budget, $110 million.
Holy cow!
That's just to get this list, just to get 2 sites prioritized on this list of 5.
I mean, it's just stunning. You and Billingsley have been doing these mapping projects around the West in Canyonlands and Grand Canyon on a budget of probably $110.
And yeah, well, what we're doing, we're talking about a Canyonlands map. If the Canyonlands Natural History Association had paid us over $50,000 or $60,000 to produce that map, I'll eat it. But anyway, our budget was nothing. So
yeah.
You don't want to look at this as a I can't remember the metaphor.
Yeah, it's sort of a pork barrel project. Just a ton of money there, but you say, okay, well, you know, we want a good product, so we're going to pay these people, you know, in gold, and see what they do. It sounds like, wow, $110 million?
Well, you know, this is who's the other guy? Goliath?
David.
What's his name?
David and Goliath.
Yeah, David and Goliath. I couldn't put my... I was trying to make Davis because I'm thinking about Davis Canyon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And this looks like a Davis and Goliath thing. You know, right.
Okay.
I mean, you're looking at... You know, let's say we're talking about $100,000 for the Canyonlands and $110 million. This is no match. But that's really not the way it works because both Woodward Clyde and Huntoon and Billingsley are simply producing scientific information.
Right.
And they're supposed to be objective.
Yeah.
And furthermore, the way this thing is structured, we all are asked, now I'm not in the picture yet, but we're all asked to not only provide information, but to share it and let the other guy see the entire hand.
Yeah.
And then you have some back and forth. In other words, what we're supposed to do, if everything is working right, is have a decent sharing of each other's information so we can check them out.
And make the best decisions for long term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a setup. Okay. It's not us against them.
Right.
But they are an advocate, of course, for the DOE. They're their contractor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, probably what will happen, and it did, is we'll end up on another side.
Okay.
And then it gets a little bit dicey. But what we have to do is behave like professionals and work with each other.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. Now, the thing is, what we've just talked about is just for Canyonlands and just for the Davis Canyon and the Lavender Canyon sites at Canyonlands, they're going to spend $110 million. This is for site screening.
Wow.
If and when one of those sites gets chosen, then they start all over, and then they characterize the site, and that's step two called site characterization. And then they start dumping lots of money into the site to test it before the first waste goes in. So the $110 million that we're talking about here is just the wart on the hog in terms of what's going to get spent before the nuclear waste gets put in the ground.
Okay.
But anyway, that's the future.
Hmm.
So, okay, now, how does this thing play out? Well, there's proponents for the site as soon as the news comes out, and there's opposition.
Right.
In general, the local Chamber of Commerce down in southeastern Utah love this idea.
Okay.
And why do they love it? Jobs, of course.
Yeah.
They want jobs. And it's going to be a big deal because they spent $110 million just characterizing the site. Just imagine what they're going to spend building it and operating it.
Right.
So the whole idea is there for it. Now, the state of Utah has a different view on it.
Oh.
The governor and the state legislature come around to a position that, you know, Utah has already paid a price for the nuclear program in the United States, and that price is cancers given to downwinders from the nuclear testing in a Nevada test site that used to send clouds of radioactive debris over St. George, Utah, in that area.
Right.
And the other thing is that the miners who used to mine small uranium deposits in the Moab and southeastern Utah area, including the Indian tribes down on the Four Corners area, they fill graveyards in southern Utah and northeastern Arizona.
You bet.
And so these people aren't so excited about having a nuclear waste repository that might pose some risk to their population.
Right.
So what they do is, and I don't remember the name of the governor of Utah, but he makes a tremendous appointment. He appoints a woman named Genevieve Atwood to head the Utah Geological Survey.
Okay.
And she was probably a perfect pick for that moment in time. It's amazing how the right person arrives when you need them. Hmm. But anyway, what she's going to do is look at this from the standpoint of the Utah Geological Society, survey, and see if they can find any problems with the site or whatever, and offer advice to the governor, just like Woodward Clyde is doing at DOE.
Okay.
Of course, Pete Perry is not hot on this idea at all because this will destroy the park's ambiance, and so he's opposed to it. And he's in the hot seat where he's in the midst of a bunch of county commissioners that are all for this thing.
Right.
So his position is very, very delicate. And what he's going to do, which was his style, is he's going to facilitate what he can to get the right information out, and part of this is help us get this map along, which is coming along serendipitously just when he needs it.
Okay.
But he's not going to be out there beating any drums because it's not appropriate. And then there's a third outfit that comes along that has a real interest in this thing, and this is the Sierra Club.
Okay.
The Sierra Club looks at this as a threat to the park, just like they looked at the threats of the dams and the Grand Canyon to parks. And what the Sierra Club has is it has an arm called the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. And this is the part of the Sierra Club that's funded by the Sierra Club that sues to prevent problems like this from happening.
Right, it's the legal arm.
Yeah, the legal department.
Yeah, yeah.
And what they have at this moment in time is a guy named Tony Ruckel, who's the head of the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. Tony Ruckel was a very talented guy who knew everybody. But anyway, and he's really kind of a lawyer lobbyist type guy.
Okay.
But anyway, he was very successful, and he ultimately became president of the Sierra Club in 1992
okay.
and 1993. So he rose after all this went by. So anyway, what happens is we're in an advanced stage of producing this map. We have draft copies of it available.
Okay.
And right away, everybody wants those because, as you saw from the guidance document, the geology was going to be a big factor here.
Yes.
And Woodward Clyde was going to analyze this geology as well as everything else. But they wanted our maps because it would save them, years. If they could just have somebody else's work and field check that.
Right. I mean, you've got the faults on it, and that's, like, huge, to know that information, because that's going to be real important. And the stratigraphy. So I would think there would be, that draft would be very valuable.
Yeah, so the draft went all over the place, We gave it to them. We gave it to the Utah Survey.
So this is 1975-ish?
Yeah, this is the mid to late 70s.
1975, 1980 time period.
You know,
so you weren't giving them thumb drives. Who was printing these things off?
Well, you remember, George is putting it on a piece of Mylar, right?
Right.
Well, all we do is run off awesome copies, and out they went.
Okay, all right.
So everybody's got them.
Okay.
And everybody that wants them has them, and... all this is going on, and we're just sitting there on the sidelines. This looks like real interesting stuff.
Hmm.
But what happens is that I'm sitting in the office, and all of a sudden I get a visitor from this guy Tony Ruckel from the Sierra Club.
Okay.
And he says, "You have something really critical here. We want to get the information that you have to the right decision makers and the people that can make a difference. We want to support you. And the way we want to support you is we would like to have you develop information on potential threats that you see near this site and package that in a presentation that we can take to Washington, D.C., and you can give these presentations to the decision-makers so they can have the information." Okay. And,
ooh, so that kind of lands you as an unbiased observer of the facts. It sort of lands you in a camp. Now, you might not mind that, but it's going to land you, squarely on one side of the fence.
Yeah, yeah. So, there's... this is a very delicate professional role, right?
Yeah.
Now, what I'm obligated to do, whether anybody believes it or not, and what and George, of course, George is not involved in this particular, aspect of this. What we've got to do is maintain our objectivity.
Okay, yeah.
And if you don't, you're going to be found out.
Well, you also work, as a professor for the University of Wyoming, and they have guidance, I'm sure, on ethics and all that kind of stuff, too. So,
yeah, that helps, That gives you a little bit of credibility,
Yeah.
I wasn't some guy off the street. But here's the thing. Woodward and Clyde and our mapping team is going to be in close contact, close professional sharing contact, which means what? They're going to be looking over my shoulder like hawks.
Yep.
And this is, in my professional career, this is one of those places where the rubber hits the road. And, you're not going to get away with a thing. And that's a kick. Now, it's a two-way street.
Hmm.
If they find a flaw, we get to fix it. because the map's in a preliminary condition.
Cool.
So, you know, I got a win-win situation here. I've got an interesting role to play in this thing, and I have a check on our work. And I just thought that this looked pretty good. So I start talking with this guy, Ruckel, and after a little while, probably, I don't know, 6 months or something like that, he makes arrangements for us, the two of us, to go to Washington, D.C., and he has made arrangements for me to give these presentations to four of the agencies that are advising the DOE, or at least four of the agencies that are involved. And the list that we have is we're going to meet with a National Park Service director, and I think at the time it was a guy named Russell Dickinson.
Okay,
I think he was the fellow that was in. The other group we were going to meet with was the U.S. Geological Survey. Now, the U.S. Geological Survey would be interested in advising the DOE on the site stability.
Makes sense.
Just like we were.
Yeah, okay.
But the fact was, the USGS wasn't involved in this process, to my knowledge, at this time.
Okay.
They were simply sitting on the sidelines as observers. And the reason for that was the DOE had given the responsibility to Woodward Clyde to do the job that the USGS probably would have liked to have had.
Interesting.
So they were just sitting on the sidelines. So the USGS is not a big factor in this thing at all at this point.
Okay.
Now, once the site is selected, then what will happen in the future is the DOE is going to contract with the USGS to do the site characterization. Not the site screening, but the characterization.
Right.
And that's going to be career jobs for a lot of people in the USGS. But at this point, they're not a big factor.
Okay.
Now, the other one that Ruckel has us talking to is the Environmental Protection Agency.
Okay.
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency has a key role in this site selection because what they have to do is judge the safety of the repository and certify that it can last a half a million years.
Okay.
Whoa. So they have a major role.
Yeah.
And they have a professional staff that's going to start worrying about this thing. And then the fourth group is the one that was really interesting. That was we were going to meet with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And they are the arm that's going to license the facility to operate.
Okay.
So that's where, in the federal government, responsibility lies. That's the group that's going to be key. The EPA and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, their opinions are going to be the thing that are used by the DOE to make the list of five priorities.
Pete, let's back up for just a second here. Can you tell me about Tony Ruckel? I mean, what was he like? Was he tall? Was he short? Was he collegial? Was he jovial? Was he a stone? What were your thoughts when you first met him?
Well, he was a real capable, well-trained lawyer,
okay.
And he was a tall fellow. Tall, slender fellow.
Okay.
Very much an environmental advocate.
Yep.
And he'd worked for the Sierra Club for a long time. He made a career of it.
Okay.
And he was a facilitator. He was one of these people.
Okay.
His job was to know who mattered and to find them and to reach them. And like I said, he was kind of a cross, in my opinion, between a good lawyer and a lobbyist. So what he's done is he knows who to reach in these agencies that will say, yeah, come on. We want to hear what these guys have to say.
Okay.
So you see, he played that key facilitator role.
Okay.
And he was a very impressive fellow. And, of course, he was a guy that was an outdoors kind of guy and that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But he'd been doing this for years when I met him.
Okay.
So anyway, okay, so cool. Now we got these guys lined up. Now let's talk about what we've got here.
So did you go out and buy a new suit? I mean, you're going to D.C. now.
Yeah, well, I'm not that kind of guy.
Okay.
I just show up, you know.
All right.
But anyway, what we do is we go to D.C. and we meet with these people. Let's talk for a minute about the site itself.
Yes.
The site is located in Canyonlands National Park, and it was reached by a Utah road that went down to the Needles District in the eastern side of Canyonlands National Park.
Okay, hang on a second. So are we talking about Davis here or Lavender?
Well, those, I'll get the geography right for you.
Yeah.
Davis and Lander Canyons are about 10 miles long, each one of them.
Okay.
And they're oriented north-south, and they drain northward to a thing called Indian Creek.
Okay.
And Indian Creek is an east-west canyon that drains westward into the Colorado River.
Yeah, I mean, the mouth of the Indian Creek is there in Meander Canyon above the confluence on the Colorado River.
That's right.
Okay.
And it comes out of a big, wide canyon called Indian Creek Canyon.
Okay.
And there's a highway, or not a highway, but a paved road that comes from the U.S., I think it's 191, westward down to the Needles District, and it goes right down Indian Canyon.
Yeah.
And it goes by a big panel of petroglyphs that everybody stops at.
Is that newspaper rock or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. And as you approach the border of Canyonlands National Park, there's a butte there that sticks up on the south side of the road, and it's called South Six Shooter Butte.
Okay.
It's a very distinctive landmark. And the land surface in the Indian Canyon is on top of the Permian-Cutler Formation.
Okay.
So it's a big, wide bench. Anyway, South Six Shooter Butte sticks up above this thing. And if we get down into the subsurface, a half a mile below the land surface is a huge thickness of the Paradox salts.
Okay.
A couple of thousand feet thick. So what they want to do is they want to build a nuclear waste repository site right next to South Six Shooter Butte and dig this hole down to this Paradox formation. And
this is just outside the borders of Canyonlands National Park?
Yeah, it's just outside. It's only a couple of miles away from the border.
Okay.
I can tell you in a second here. You know, it's
so a couple miles east.
Yeah, it's a couple of miles east. And then, you know, the mouth of Davis and Lavender Canyons are right near there. And yeah, we're only talking about a mile or two from the border.
Wow. Okay.
So the park is not excited about this.
Right.
Now, what happens is that you got to imagine this facility. This is a gigantic operation. They're going to have a railroad they've got to build from Moab down
Ooh.
To this place. That railroad in the vicinity of the site is going to be four tracks wide.
Holy cow.
They're going to build a freeway into there so that they can have trucks going in and out of there.
Okay, hang on a second. Let me think about this for a minute because I'm trying to think about where is the railroad in Moab? Well, there's a railroad that goes down to the potash mine, and they would have to jump that railroad on a trestle across the Colorado River and then get it out of there up on the highlands again.
Yeah, well, they go around, you know, they could either go down the canyon or whatever they could do, and they would come out. A little bit north of this South Six Shooter Butte and go straight south to the facility.
Wow.
So this thing would be visible from all the high parts of the park, right, like the island and the sky.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'd cross these tracks going out to the wilderness by, out by the Needles. So, you know, okay. And then the other thing you got is you got a freeway coming in there, probably down the canyon, Indian Canyon. And so those are going to be the accesses. And okay. then you're going to have a big facility, you know, a facility to handle the waste, unload it, to handle it and get it down in a hole. And besides that, you're going to be mining out all this stuff to make room for this material.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we're talking about an industrial complex going in down
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
So this is a real, you know, this was not one of those bright things that the DOE proposed. It just isn't, it just doesn't hold water. Wait, it's on the board, and it's going to be seriously looked at.
Okay.
Okay, so what goes on now is we start providing them with the map, and everybody is scrutinizing this thing. Now, what we've mapped, which is important to them, is we've mapped areas where we know we have wholesale salt dissolution from the top of the Paradox in the subsurface, and one of these areas is a place called Lockhart Basin, which is about 6 or 8 miles north of Six Shooter Butte, and this is an area that's about 2 miles in diameter, where there's been enough salt dissolution in the Paradox to allow the surface to fall about 1,500 or 2,000 feet.
Okay,
so
this is a major
problem.
When you say salt dissolution, can you explain that?
Well,
I think you did yesterday, but do it again.
Yeah, well, we haven't discussed that at all.
Okay.
What we find is we find this feature, which is a collapse feature, like a huge sinkhole.
All right.
And it tells us that the salt is missing underneath there. What's really nice is years ago, an oil company drilled a couple of wells in Lockhart Basin, and they drilled all the way down to the salt looking for oil. And I had a graduate student named Henry Richter who was doing his thesis in there, and he got the original records from those oil wells.
The oil well logs,
and
okay.
And these proved that they had dissolution collapse there.
How does that happen? How does dissolution happen? What is it?
Well, this is a situation that's tough. I have a theory, but it doesn't matter. What happened is, somehow there was groundwater circulation at the top of the Paradox, and it simply started to dissolve the Paradox. And then as it started to dissolve the Paradox, we had breccia pipes propagate up from that all the way up to the top, 2,000 feet.
Right.
And when they broke out, they formed the conduit that allowed more water to circulate through, and the process just accelerated until you dissolved down about, I don't know, maybe 1,500 feet into the Paradox.
So the breccia pipes, once you have one pipe to the surface, then that becomes a water conduit to bring more water down into the salts.
Right.
Okay.
And probably the initial thing that allowed for the circulation was some kind of a extensional fracture along one of these anticlines that was developing above the salt.
Oh.
It stretched it, and the water could circulate through the fractures and get to the Paradox, and some of it could come up. However it happened, it happened.
Okay.
The point isn't how did it happen. The fact is that it was real and it happened.
Right.
And this is something that their guidance document anticipated. And, you know, the guys that wrote the document, they never knew anything about this place, but they put this on the list as a bad thing. And there we got one of the best examples of it in all of the Colorado Plateau. So, you know, this was fun. And
Let me make, 'cause that's a key point you just said. So was this the Department of Energy that said, we're going to put together some key things we're going to look for that will be showstoppers, and one is collapse features, breccia pipes. And,
yeah.
And so if we see that, we're going to be pretty uncomfortable with that site as a place to select.
Yeah, exactly.
And you guys show up and you say, hey, look at Lockhart. It's
yeah,
a huge breccia pipe.
Yeah, we got these things.
Cool.
And then the other thing, one of the other things on their list was that they didn't want faults.
Uh-huh.
And or active tectonic structures.
Okay.
So we've got two of the three. We've got these dissolution collapse features. We've got breccia pipes. And the other thing now, is there any active faults there? Well, or any active structures? They don't want the ground moving
right
on the
right,
site.
Right.
So what happens is that we're looking at the geologic map, and what Billingsley was using for the Quaternary alluvium was yellow. That stands out like a sore thumb visually, which we, you know, just happened to be. And what I noticed was, if we went up, what's the name of that? It's
I hear some big maps moving.
Yeah, well, I'm looking, but I can't get to that thing in fast enough. Well, I'm trying to, the Indian draw, I can't remember the full name of the thing. As we go up Indian Canyon, what we see is about 10 or 12 miles up from the river, we see that all of a sudden we have all this yellow on the map.
Okay.
And that's upstream. And when you look at where the yellow starts, you see that there's a very gentle anticline that crosses Indian Creek. And what this suggests is that that anticline, the axis of the anticline, is acting as a dam that's blocking Indian Creek, and the Quaternary rocks are deposited behind it, and downstream they're washed away into the Colorado River, and there's none of them there.
Okay.
So that's kind of an interesting observation. And when we go out on the ground, that's exactly what we see. There's this very gentle anticline, and upstream of it is a sedimentary basin that is filling with modern sediments. What does that tell you? It tells you that the anticline is actually rising today.
Ooh.
And this is something that, you know, I didn't make a big deal out of this thing, but we noticed it. Anyway, this starts looking like some potential strikes against the safety of this site, and everybody's really interested in it. Now, I'll tell you, the DOE guys, the Woodward Clyde guys, are really, really good. And my primary contact with them was a guy named John Thaxton. And Woodward Clyde had the money and the horsepower to hire the best guys there were. So these guys are all good that we're meeting and discussing this stuff with. And after a little while, Thaxton finally arranges for us to George and me to come down to Canyonlands and fly around with them in their helicopter and take a look at all these critical sites and all this kind of stuff. And so we do that. To give you, they got a budget of $110 million they're going to spend over a couple of years. That's a lot of helicopter time. And they had so much helicopter time flying around the Canyonlands area that they finally had one go down on them.
Oh, no.
And it broke the leg of one, I think it was a woman geologist that was along, but fortunately nobody was killed.
Thank
you. But
heavens.
I mean, so we went down there and flew around for a day or so, and imagine this. They got us up in this helicopter, and we're looking at stuff that's very sensitive to them, and of course of very great importance to me, and I got a camera and I'm photographing this stuff. And I'm going to take it to Washington and show it to these agencies as liabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, well, that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
But the deal is we're all objective, okay?
Nice.
And one thing happens, this is on me. There was a little fault that I mapped up in Davis Canyon. It was about a quarter of a mile long. I mean, there was nothing to it. It was just a little thing that I noticed on aerial photos. What it was a 15-foot scarp that went diagonally into this butte. And I just put a line on it, and it looked like the east side was down, so I put an up-down on it,
mm-hmm.
and it was sitting on a map, you know, and it didn't make much sense, but it was out there in the middle of nowhere. Well, it was right over their repository horizon.
Ooh.
So, of course, those guys had to go look at this thing, and they went out there and looked at it, and I get this phone call from somebody, and whoever it was says, hey, you know, you got this fault on here, and we need more information because we've been out there and, you know, we can't find this thing. Well, that's a little embarrassing, right?
Yeah.
So there I am sitting in Laramie, Wyoming. The next weekend, I took off Friday afternoon. I drive down there and I get out there to the site and I got to hike in 6 miles to get to this damn thing. And what I find is that this thing was an old stream channel that was eroded into the top of the unit it was on, probably the Cutler Formation, and it subsequently got buried by younger rocks, and then when the canyon eroded, it eroded this thing out and left that scarp there, and it was a false hit. So, of course, I had to take it off the map. But anyway, I'll tell you, when I arrived at that site, I'm hiking in. When I arrived there, that thing was absolutely trampled. There were helicopter skid marks on the soil. There were footprints absolutely everywhere. These guys had been out there. This thing looked like an entrance to a subway station in New York City.
Wow.
It was absolutely trampled. That was the level of detail. That was the scrutiny we were getting.
Okay.
And I'm sitting there. I'm glad to have the error off the map.
Yeah.
But I'm really impressed that these guys are working at that level with our map, but the interesting thing is they're not adding anything new to the map.
Ooh.
Well, that's good. They didn't find anything.
Aha!
See what I mean? So there's a win-win. But, you know, you gotta, you know, when you're doing this kind of work, you can't get defensive about stuff. You just gotta accept that you're
not perfect. That's right.
Yeah,
and you know, the best data wins. I mean, meaning, you know, bring it on.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and you know, all of us realize this is one of the greatest things we're doing in our career.
Hmm.
We're here, you know, you kind of know that, you know, and I felt real good about this thing. Well, anyway, so we go to Washington, and we meet with these various agencies. The first one that we went to was the National Park Service Director. And what they did is they brought us right into the director's office, and we're sitting in the director's office, and he was out running an errand, and asked us to set up. I'm setting up the slide projector right on the guy's desk, and we're shooting the pictures on the wall across the room.
Cool.
But anyway, he comes in. This guy's a busy guy, and I got an hour presentation, and of course, I'm not going to waste his time, and I give it to him in 15 minutes, and he's very pleased to see it and have the overview, and out the door we go.
Okay.
And then we go on to the USGS in Reston, and we're met with ambivalence because they really aren't heavily involved at this time, and besides, they're kind of smarting because they didn't get the contracts to do this stuff. I don't know what's going on, but anyway. Then we move on to the EPA, and things start to get real interesting. This is the second day, I suppose. The deal is, when we arrive at the EPA, this is a group that is vitally involved in helping DOE make the decisions, and they're interested, and they practically fill a room with their technical experts to hear what we have to say, and we get a real good audience there. And they're listening. And they're really listening critically, and they're concerned about some of these features that we're finding. They really want to pass on this site to get the project rolling, but they've got to be careful. And this is important. Well, then the last one was the big unknown to me. This is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I didn't know what to expect there. They were the people that were going to license this facility if it was chosen.
Okay.
And so we showed up at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Well, we walked in, and they ushered us into a room. And here was this room that was filled with their technical people and administrators. And there must have been 15 or 20 of them. I don't know. Maybe, you know, this is an old memory.
Mm-hmm.
But there were plenty of these guys in this room. And these guys, they're interested in licensing. They've got to certify that this site is good.
Right.
And they can't license it otherwise. And so they're all ears. And they were the most receptive group that we ran into.
Ah.
And this was really interesting. So I give my presentation, you know. And I point out this... I point out these Breccia pipes and all this stuff, and you know, they're a distance enough away, they're not the big threat. But anyway, I also talk about this Indian Creek anticline, and okay, fine. Two things happened at that particular meeting. I'll never forget them in my life. One day, I had been driving from Indian Creek over to Lockhart Basin, and the lighting was perfect, and I stopped, we were on a dirt road. I stopped the truck, got out, and I took a scenic view looking up the road towards the north, towards Lockhart Basin with Indian Creek behind me.
Cool.
And I got the most beautiful picture. It was looking along the top of the Cutler, and there were juniper trees that were perfectly framing the foreground and the red rocks in the background. And that was one of the photographs that I flashed up on the screen.
Okay.
And I said, what you're looking at is the right-of-way for the railroad that they're going to build down here to serve the facility, and what you're looking at is a right-of-way that's going to have four tracks.
Wow.
And from the back of the room, I hear this voice, over my dead body.
Whoa!
You know, that was pretty good. Then I got done with the thing, you know, and... I went in, I had to go take a leak, went into the men's room, and I'm sitting at the urinal, and
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden a guy pulls up next to me in the other urinal, and he looks over at me and he says, you know what, having you come in today is like having a laborer come in and tell us we left the rebar out of the third floor of the reactor.
Oh my God.
I'm sitting there, holy smokes.
Wow.
Well, anyway, a little time goes by, and about two or three months later, I got a phone call from the geologist that was there, one of the nuclear regulatory geologists that
okay.
was there. And he said, you know, you were talking about that Indian Creek anticline, and that really looked interesting to me. And, of course, he said, I think that's pretty critical. And he said, I've done some work on it. Well, I'm sitting there, wow, somebody got lit on this thing. And what the guy had done was fantastic. He had made a very detailed profile along the course of the Indian Creek anticline, along Indian Creek, where it crossed the anticline, all the way from its headwaters down to the river, which was, you
know, oh, wow.
25-mile profile. And what he documented was that above the axis of the Indian Creek anticline, the gradient was about a half of what it was below it.
Oh, wow.
In other words,
yeah. It's like a dam.
It was filling with sediment behind
yeah.
it, and downstream it was getting washed out. And it was unambiguous. That structure is active.
Wow, okay.
And I didn't do it. The nuclear regulatory guy did it.
Ooh.
That's what you want.
Handy.
If you're opposed to this thing.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, when the smoke clears, this is early 80s, something like that, the DOE finally prioritizes this site. And what they do is they put Yucca Mountain first, Hanford second, and then they got Davis, and then they got Lavender, and then they got Deaf Smith.
Okay.
All the salt sites are below the line, and they're out of consideration. And Canyonlands has this burden off them.
Wow.
That was one of the most important things I was ever involved in. And I'll tell you, if anything ever justified my life on this earth, it was having had a minor role in this thing.
Nice.
And this was
wow.
really a pretty interesting experience to go through. Now, what happened was, is that this became very controversial. And all of a sudden, Congress got tired of the controversy that's rolling over this proposed nuclear repository, and they decide to just arbitrarily pick a site and go with it. And so what they did is they threw all this work in the trash, and they came out with the Nuclear Waste Policy Act in 1982 that said that the nuclear waste is going to Yucca Mountain in Nevada, and that's the end of the story. And so Harry Reid, who was the Speaker of the Senate, he has this land on him. And why did it land on him? Well, Nevada has one of the smallest congressional delegations in the country.
Yeah,
and, and Harry Reid looked at this situation, and he always called the Nuclear Waste Act of 1982 the Screw Nevada Act.
And, well, didn't Yucca Mountain eventually prove to be geologically unstable?
Well, they're still fiddling with it.
Are they? Okay.
Harry killed it by freezing the funds to characterize it.
Oh.
They've already built a tunnel all the way down to the repository horizon, a big U-shaped thing, a couple of miles long, and they've gotten in the heart of this thing, and I've been in it. You know, of course, I've gotten invited to these things, and I've seen all this stuff.
All right.
But anyway, that thing is... they had a big boring machine that did this. It was a really big project. But anyway, that thing's been on ice, and we haven't disposed of the high-level waste.
Right.
That's all there is to it.
Right. So my question to you then, Peter, is, I mean, just thinking about the geology of the planet, there it just seems to me there's no place safe for this stuff.
Well, you know, there probably is. I could pick some sites that I could live with.
Where would you choose? What would you be thinking about?
Well, anything I would put, I would look in the mid-continent region, which is geologically as stable as we've got in the country. We've got to find a site within the boundaries of our own country because we're creating the waste.
That's right. So thinking about, you know, Nebraska?
Go out in the middle of Nebraska. But the problem is, you start talking about putting nuclear waste out there, you've got real constituencies that are going to fight you. Everywhere you go, you got these constituencies.
Well, of course. I mean, this is nobody wants this in their backyard. I get that. But if we're simply just looking at the geology, because you're looking for anticlines, you're looking for breccia pipes, you're looking for faults, you're looking for water inundation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, where the heck do you go that doesn't have any of that stuff?
Well, it's the earth. It's kind of a tough proposition. Yeah, we've kind of created a little bit of a problem here with our nuclear waste.
Right.
And, of course, the defense industry, they made atomic bombs. They've got nuclear waste coming out their ears.
Right.
And they're looking for another site, or they're looking for the same site.
Yep.
So we're in that. This is a dilemma. Hey, look, there's a lot of problems we got. You can't solve them easily.
Well, that's right.
But you don't try to stick one of these things next to a national park. That's not too politically savvy.
Right.
That's all there is to it, you know.
Yeah.
And so this is the way. Now, this is my opinion. I have this opinion.
Sure.
But when we were working through this process, I had to be objective about presenting this data. I simply showed them what I found.
Yeah.
And what George found.
Yep.
We just showed them what we found.
Yeah.
And what happened, if you think about this, this was one of those great examples of serendipity.
Mm-hmm.
Pete Perry arrives at the park. This thing lands on his shoulders just before it landed on him, maybe a year or so before that. He authorizes the mapping of the canyon, so he's got a geologic resource at his fingertips.
Wow, yeah, that's
just
that's
what he needed.
Beautiful timing.
Yeah, and before the map is published, you've got the information.
And then the Sierra Club gets involved. Ruckel gathers you up, takes you to D.C. I mean, it was a lot of stars all aligning there.
Yeah. This doesn't always happen, right?
Wow.
And, you know, to be a bit player in this thing was just an amazing experience. And I just felt lucky to have been in the right place at the right time.
Nice.
And, you know, the outcome, that's, not my problem. The outcome, in my opinion, turned out to be rational.
Right, right,
but,
which is good.
The outcome wasn't, you know, if it went the other way, I would have to live with it. It was just
right.
The data we provided said, okay, go with it.
I mean, if there were no Breccia pipes, there were no anticlines, I would think that a half-mile deep big bed of salt that was dry, that didn't have any water incursion, might be a good idea.
Yeah, right. Well, what
and
do you
the stuff's got to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And it needs to be there for 500,000 years, all nice and left alone.
Well, that's where we are. So, you know, the thing is that, yeah, working through these problems, if you're an academic like I am, or I was, sometimes they actually have consequences.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, we look at Canyonlands. It was a great opportunity.
I'm thrilled that you put that picture in there, you know, looking north. You know, that's I think to help people realize, you know, we're sort of, you know, people in offices and trenches working in Washington, D.C., don't necessarily have a chance to understand what the heck the rest of the country looks like, where these places are going to go. And so that was very good.
Well, that was just lucky, you know.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that's the story of the... Now, Canyonlands was really good to me. We had, for outdoor activity, great hiking, great river running. You couldn't ask for better. I had two or three thesis projects down there.
Cool.
Those students contributed key information to this project.
Oh, cool.
Richter getting the oil well data for Lockhart Basin.
Yeah,
He dug that out of the weeds in Denver from some oil company that was I'd never heard of. But anyway, all this, you know, it all just came together.
Wow. Yeah. Very cool. How many thesis, either masters or PhDs, did you actually direct into Canyonlands area and that actually went to defense?
Well, probably I think I had three in Canyonlands.
Okay.
And one or two down on the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
Yeah. That's,
cool.
Yeah,
that's, all right. Very fun.
And
very
you
fun.
Know those were guys that could handle. Tough environments, and they were willing to get out there and work.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, these were really good people.
Oh, very fun. Very
and
cool.
And they've all done well.
Cool. Well, that's fun.
Well, anyway, that was part of it. This is one dimension of the Canyonlands project.
Okay.
It was a great project. It
cool.
was a great project because we learned so much. The other half of it that turned out to be so good was that there was that upheaval impact crater in the north part of the park.
Yes.
And that fell in my lap. And when I finally realized that that thing was an impact crater, then I had to do about a year's work of learning about impact craters. And that just took me into a dimension of geology that's unbelievably interesting and totally new to me. And there was a guy at the University of Arizona that wrote a book on impact craters.
Hmm.
His name was Jay Malosh, and it's a very quantitative book. It's about 200 or 300 pages long.
Okay.
And I read that book to master it because he talked about every aspect of this. And, of course, what I'm doing is I'm looking to see if the geometries and the stress patterns he's writing about match what I see, and of course it's a hand and glove situation.
Oh, interesting.
But
cool.
Anyway, you know, that was one of those situations where I read that book so carefully I was able to send him a list of the typos in it, you know.
Oh, wow. Cool.
But anyway, you know, when you're in this game, when you're an academic, the learning never stops if you're doing research.
Nice.
And this was one of those wonderful cases, the impact thing, where I had a steep learning curve that was just thoroughly enjoyable. And just after I got done with that, here comes Chicxulub with the killing of the dinosaurs. And, of course, it was something that you could see as plausible.
Well, this is interesting. You know, I'm sort of thinking of nuclear waste and trying to find a geological area that's stable, And then the next thing that happens is you have a world-class meteorite come hurtling out of the sky that lands on this thing and blows the whole damn thing wide open.
Yeah.
So there really is no place safe.
No, there isn't. But,
wow.
But we don't want one of these things coming in, let me tell you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but they have and they will. It's just part of being a planet in a solar system in a galaxy, you know.
Yeah, they're just improbable, you know. They're gonna, you know, but there'll be another one.
Yeah,
they're out there.
Yeah, exactly. They're out there. So there really is. You could find the best geology in the world, and then you put this stuff in there, and 6 years later, some meteor comes out of the sky, and boom. Interesting.
Well, the thing, one thing is, you know, working on Canyonlands was just part of my life at that point.
Hmm.
I was probably devoting 20 or 30% of my time to it, but I had a full-time teaching job, and this was part of my research commitment to the university. We had to have research projects that we were publishing on.
Ah.
So this gave me publications and that, so it helped me. And, of course, what it did is that I was able to develop coursework from this that I taught. So this thing just helped a lot, and it was just...
Nice.
Interesting.
Nice. Excellent.
Just made my life dynamic. It was amazing.
I want to just go back to some of your family life. You mentioned Victoria. When did you meet her?
Oh, I don't know, somewhere around 76 or something like that.
So kind of right in this time.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We ultimately parted company about 2000, or not 2000. It was. Much earlier than that, but anyway.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Okay, just kind of want to capture some family in here. Okay, this sounds like maybe a good place to pause this interview series. Is there anything else about Canyonlands that we want to cover?
Oh, well, there's no end to it, but we've done enough.
Well, maybe next time we'll fill in some more gaps in the Canyonlands world. Okay, with that then, let's conclude Part 9 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Peter Huntoon. Today is Wednesday, October 4th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Peter, thank you so very much.
Okay.